content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. Our first article today is from the health section, and it is entitled The Last Days of American Orange Juice, and it's written by Yasmin Tayang. Whenever my mom comes to visit, she scolds me for not having orange juice in my fridge. What about your health? She asks, to which I reply, what about my bank account? As in many families, orange juice was always on the breakfast table when I was growing up. It was affordable, delicious, and full of vitamin C. The high levels of sugar were considered less of a problem at the time. But orange juice isn't so cheap anymore. Tropicana, for instance, has shrunk its bottles and raised prices in recent years. And since 2019, the price of concentrate has increased by about 80%. Chances are slim that it'll go down anytime soon. Some of this is because of inflation. And if President Donald Trump ever goes through with the tariffs he has threatened against Mexico and Canada, orange juice, which once came to the Americas, to Americans from Florida, but is now generally made from a mix of international oranges, could become even more expensive. Yet orange juice also is facing a grander existential problem than the economy. The world's biggest orange producers aren't growing as much fruit as they used to. As orange availability slides, the era of orange juice ubiquity is rapidly coming to an end. The primary cause is a disease known as citrus greening, when tiny, hard-to-control insects called Asian citrus psyllids feed on orange trees, they inject bacteria that floods the tree's veins. Fruits become rancid, misshapen, and discolored. Within a few years, the tree dies. Around the world, millions of acres of orange trees have succumbed. And in the past 20 years, production in Florida's storied orange groves, which once supplied the majority of America's juice, has declined 92%. What little fruit is left on the trees gets blown to the ground by hurricanes, which are becoming more destructive in the state. Growers have a few tools to mitigate the disease, such as antibiotic injections and plant growth sprays to boost fruit production, but they are costly and labor-intensive to use. Many have given up and sold their generations-old groves to real estate developers. In January, one of Tropicana's suppliers, Alico, announced that it will no longer invest capital in its citrus operations once the current crop is harvested, because its business is no longer, quote, economically viable. Citrus greening has no cure. Labs around the country are racing to develop disease-resistant trees, but research is slow because trees take up to 8 years to bear fruit. Tripti Yashishis, a citrus expert at the University of Florida's Institute of Food and Agricultural Sciences, told me, at the rate trees are dying, a solution is likely to come too late. The dwindling fruit supply is making orange juice harder, but not impossible to produce. Other orange-growing countries are contributing more of the juice sold in U.S. stores. Out of curiosity, I read the ingredients on a carton of Florida's Natural at the grocery store. Juice from Mexico, Florida, and Brazil. These countries haven't yet been hit as hard by the citrus greening as Florida. About 40% of their crops have been affected so far. Still, their supply is uncertain, too. American orange juice manufacturers will be on edge until April, when the impact of citrus greening on this year's crop in Brazil will first become apparent. Andres Padilla, a citrus supply expert at Rabobank, a bank serving the agricultural industry, told me, if the situation worsens, companies may have to source oranges from countries even farther abroad, such as Spain, Italy, Turkey, and India, where the disease is less pronounced. For the juice industry, international oranges are more of a lifeline than a long-term fix. The only places where citrus greening isn't affecting orange groves yet are Europe and Australia, Vashish said. Imported fruit can be costly, and its flavor varies because of differences in variety, growing conditions, and taste preferences. European oranges skew tart because locals like their juice sour, while American varieties cater to the nation's sweet tooth. To maintain the flavor profile that U.S. customers expect, manufacturers would have to blend different batches of juice, much like they would batches of wine or whiskey. For the industry, those blends mark a big shift from a time when orange juice products were proudly made and consumed in America. Everybody went for the 100% Florida. It was a premium juice without any doubt, Carol Sliga, a beverage industry consultant, told me. After the citrus greening crisis started in the early 2000s, the 100% Florida label began to disappear from cartons. More poignant, orange juice itself is beginning to lose significance. It's definitely already a much smaller category than it was 20 years ago, Padilla said. Other beverages such as teas, coffees, seltzers, energy drinks, and bottled waters, some of which sugar-conscious consumers might view as healthier alternatives, have helped nudge it out. And some juice makers are extending their orange supply with juice from other fruits, such as tangerines and mandarins, which aren't affected by citrus greening, and even apple and lemon. Plus, as family sizes shrink and growing numbers of people live alone, people are simply buying less orange juice, Padilla said. I ended up buying a carton of Florida's Natural at a grocery store. It cost about $5. Reasonable, I thought, as long as my family doesn't drain it too quickly. We savored every drop. Orange juice as a category will not disappear entirely, because people will pay up for goods they see as healthy, Sliga told me. But maintaining the custom of a daily glass will either be that much more costly, or it will break. In many ways, the decline of orange juice represents the future of many staple foods. Continuous abundance, a prerequisite for staples, is no longer guaranteed. More and more, the notion of the classic American breakfast, bacon, eggs, toast, milk, coffee, and a glass of orange juice, is beginning to seem like a snapshot of a bygone era. Not only is the supply of orange juice becoming shaky, but so is that of eggs, milk, and coffee, not to mention other goods such as chocolate and olive oil. None of this means that we'll have to go without these foods anytime soon, but for everyday Americans, it will likely mean having less. Our next story, Bluetooth speakers are ruining music, by Michael Owen. When I was in my early 20s commuting to work over the freeways of Los Angeles, I listened to Brian Wilson's 2004 album, Smile, several hundred times. I like the Beach Boys just fine, but I'm not a super fan, and the decades-long backstory of Smile never really hooked me. But the album itself was sonic mesmerism, each hyper-produced number slicking into the next, with Wilson's baroque, sometimes cartoonish tinkering laid over 1,000 stars of sunshine. If I tried to listen again and my weathered Mazda mutely regurgitated the disc, as it often did, I could still hear the whole thing in my head. Around this time, a friend invited me to see Wilson perform at the Hollywood Bowl, which is a 17,000-seat outdoor amphitheater tucked into the hills between L.A. and the San Fernando Valley. Elsewhere, This could have been a scene of sensory overload, but its eye of the storm geography made the bowl kind of redoubt, cool and dark, and almost hushed under a purple sky. My friend and I opened our wine bottle, and Wilson and his band took the stage. From the first note of the a cappella opening, they wobbled. The instruments, Wilson's voice, all of it stretched and wavered through each beat of the album, which constituted their set list, as if they were playing not in a band shell, but far down a desert highway on a hot day, right against the horizon. Wilson's voice in particular verged on frail, so far from the immaculate silk of the recording as to seem like a reinvention. Polished and rhythmic, the album had been all machine, but the performance was human. Humans by the thousand, making and hearing the music, and for me it was like watching consciousness flicker on for the first time in the head of a beloved robot. Music is different now. Finicky CD players are a rarity, for one thing. We hold the divine power instead to summon any song we can think of almost anywhere. In some respects, our investment in how we listen has kept pace. People wear $500 headphones on the subway. They fork out the GDP of East Timor to see Taylor Swift across an arena. But the engine of this musical era is access. Forever, music was tethered to the human scale, performers and audience in a space small enough to carry an organic or mechanical sound. People alive today knew people who might have heard the first transmitted concert, a fragile experiment over telephone lines at the Paris Opera in 1881. Now a library of music too big for a person to hear in seven lifetimes has surfed the smartphone to most corners of the earth. In another important way, though, how we listen has shrunk. Not in every instance, but often enough to be worthy of attention. The culprit is the single speaker, as opposed to a pair of them, like your ears. And once you start looking for it, you might see it everywhere, an invasive species of flower fringing the highway. Every recorded sound we encounter is made up of layers of artifice, of distance from the originating disturbance of air. So this isn't an argument about some standard of acoustic integrity. Rather, it's about the space we make with music and what or who will fit inside. From early years of recorded music, the people selling it have relied on a dubious language of fidelity, challenging the listener to tell a recording apart from the so-called real thing. This is silly, even before you hear some of those old tinny records. We do listen to sound waves, of course, but we also absorb them with the rest of our body, and beyond the sound of the concert are all the physical details of its production, staging, lighting, amplification, decor. We hear some of that happening, too, and we see it, just as we see and sense the rising and falling of the people in the seats around us, as we feel the air whipping off their applauding hands or settling into the subtly different stillnesses of enrapturement or boredom. People will keep trying to reproduce all of that artificially, no doubt, because the asymptote of fidelity is a moneymaker. But each time you get one new piece of the experience right, you've climbed just high enough to crave the next rung on the ladder. Go back down instead to the floor of the most mundane auditorium, and you'll feel before you can name all the varieties of sensation that make it real. For a long time, the Fidelity cell was a success. When American men got home from World War II, as the cultural historian Tony Grijalva has noted, they presented a new consumer class. Marketing phrases such as, quote, concert hall realism, end quote, got them buying audio equipment. With the advent of stereo sound with separated left and right channels, which became practical for home use in the late 50s, was an economic engine for makers of both recordings and equipment. All of that needed to be replaced in order to enjoy the new technology. The New York Times dedicated whole sections to the stereo transition. Record dealers, including a considerable number, who do not think that stereo is as yet an improvement over monophonic discs, are hopeful that, with sufficient advertising and other forms of publicity, the consumer will be converted, a 1958 article observed. Acoustic musicians were integral to the development of recorded sound, and these pioneers understood that the mixing panel was now as important as any instrument. When Bell Laboratories demonstrated its new stereophonic technology in a spectacle at Carnegie Hall in 1940, the conductor Leopold Stokowski ran the audio levels himself, essentially remixing live the sounds he'd recorded with his Philadelphia orchestra. Stokowski had worked for years with his pal Walt Disney to create a prototype of surround sound for Fantasia. The result was a system too elaborate to replicate widely, which had to be abandoned and its parts donated to the war effort before the movie went into national distribution. Innovators like Stokowski recognized a different emerging power in multi-channel sound, more persuasive and maybe more self-justifying than the mere simulation of the live experience, to make and then remake in living rooms and dens across the country an aural stage without a physical correlate, an acoustic space custom built in the recording studio, with a soundtrack pieced together from each isolated instrument and voice. The musical space had always been monolithic, with players and listeners sharing it for the fleeting moment of performance. The recording process divided that space into three: one for recording the original sound, one for listening, and an abstract theoretical sound stage created by the mixing process in between. That notational space could have a size and shape of its own warmth and coolness and reverberance, and it could reposition each element of the performance in three dimensions, at the inclination of the engineer, who might also be the performer. Glenn Gould won permanent fame with his recordings of Bach's keyboard works in the 1950s. Although he was as formidable and flawless a live performer as you'll get, his first recording innovation, and that it was at the time, was to splice together many different takes of his performances to yield an exaggerated, daring perfection in every phase of every piece, as if LeBron James only showed up on TV in highlight reels. "Listen, we've got lots of endings," Gould tells his producer in one recording session, a scene recalled in Paul Early's terrific Reinventing Bach. By the 1970s, the editors of the anthology Living Stereo note, Gould had hacked the conventional use of multi-mic recording, but instead of using it to render the conventional image of the concert hall stage, he used the various microphone positions to create an effect of a highly mobile acoustic space, what he sometimes referred to as an acoustic orchestration, or choreography. It was akin to shooting a studio film with a handheld camera, reworking the whole relationship of perceiver to perceived. Pop music was surprisingly slow to match the classicist's creativity. Many of the commercial successes of the 60s were mastered in mono, which became an object of nostalgic fascination after the record companies later re-engineered them in simulated stereo to goose sales. Had it been released by the Beach Boys back then, Smile would have been a single-channel record. And in fact, Brian Wilson himself is deaf in one ear. It wasn't until the late 60s, when Pink Floyd championed experiments in quadraphonic sound with four speakers, that pop music became a more reliable scene of fresh approaches in both recording and production. Nowadays, even the most rudimentary pop song is a product of engineering you couldn't begin to grasp without a few master's degrees. But the technologicalization of music producing, distribution, and consumption is full of paradoxes. For the first 100 years from the Paris Opera Telephone Experiment to the release of the compact disc in the early 1980s, recording was an uneven but inexorable march toward higher quality, as both a selling point and an artistic aim. Then came file sharing in the late 90s and the iPod and its descendant, the iPhone, all of which compromised the quality of the music in favor of smaller files that could flourish on a low-bandwidth internet. Convenience and scale at the expense of quality. Bluetooth, another powerful warrior in the forces of convenience, made similar trade-offs in order to spare us a cord. Alexa and Siri gave us new reasons to put a multifunctional speaker in our kitchens and bathrooms and garages. And the ubiquity of streaming services brought the whole chain together, one suboptimal link after another, landing us in a pre-Stokowski era of audio quality grafted onto a barely fathomable utopia of access, all music, everywhere, in mediocre form. People still listen to music in their car, or on headphones, of course, and many others have multi-channel audio setups of one kind or another. Solitary speakers tend to be additive, showing up in places you wouldn't think to rig for the best sound, in the dining room, on the deck, at the beach. They're digital successors to the boombox and the radio, more about the presence of sound than its shape. Yet what many of these places have in common is that they're where people actually congregate. The landmark concerts and the music we listen to by ourselves keep getting richer, their real and figurative stages more complex. I don't think I've ever felt a greater sense of space than at Beyoncé's show in the Superdome 2 Septembers ago. But our everyday communal experience of music has suffered. A speaker designed to get you to order more toilet paper, piping out its lonely strain from the corner of your kitchen. It's the first time since the arrival of hi-fi almost a century ago that we're so widely acceded to making the music in our lives smaller. For Christmas, I ordered a pair of $60 Bluetooth speakers. This kind of thing has been a running joke with my boyfriend since a more ambitious Sonos setup showed up in his empty new house a few days after closing, the only thing I needed to make the place livable. I've got you some more speakers, babe. We followed the instructions to pair them in stereo, then took them out to the fire pit, where we'd been scraping by with a single unit. I hung them from opposite trees, opened up Spotify, and let the algorithmic playlist roll. In the flickering darkness, you could hear the silence of the stage open up, like the moments when the conductor mounts the podium in Fantasia. As the music began, it seemed to come not from a single point on the ground, like we were used to, but from somewhere out in the woods or up in the sky. Or maybe from a time before all this, when the musician would have been one of us, seated in the glow and wrapping us in another layer of warmth. This wasn't high-fidelity sound. There wasn't a stereo sweet spot, and the bass left something to be desired. But the sound made a space, and we were in it, together. And now for a Dear James story. My friend's Instagram account has taken a dark turn. By James Parker. Dear James, I have a friend I used to be very close with. I was in her wedding party 8 years ago, but life circumstances, life's goals, and geographic distance have rendered us a lot less so. We don't communicate much aside from reacting nicely to each other's Instagram stories, which don't reveal a lot about a person. Recently, her posts, usually just happy photo dumps of her cat and vacations with her partner, have taken a turn. They're full of odd quotes about being a bigger person, learning not to hate, purging one's soul. She also posted an Instagram story that made me think her cat was dead. But I follow her partner, too, and it seems that this person now lives in a separate city with the cat. I feel called to check in, but all avenues seem awkward. Our last text exchange was just sharing links to news stories from months ago. Who am I to text, "Hey, I saw on Instagram, you may be going through something"? I could send her a message on Instagram, but that seems insufficiently serious if she's indeed going through a dark period as a result of what I presume to be a separation. If my presumption is wrong, then reaching out would be even more awkward. Any insight here? Dear reader, this is why I'm not on Instagram. You don't get news about a person. You get shifts in curatorial policy. But it sounds as if your friend, unless she's working on an elaborate cover story before embedding with a politically suspect performance art troupe, is going through something. And as you've been conducting your own informal probe into her situation, you've been keeping in mind the old journalist's maxim, follow the cat. The cat has moved. The cat's in a different city. The self-help quotes are proliferating. I smell brokenness. The question is, do you want to help her, or are you just kind of fascinatedly tracking the downturn on her online vibes? Another Instagram effect. It turns us into disassociated consumers of one another's lives. If you do want to help her, and you are in her wedding party, which in my book gives you a stake, however remote, in this marriage, then I see nothing wrong with checking in via text, carrier pigeon, whatever. In fact, I would say definitely do it. It's never too late or too early or too weird to see if somebody's okay. Encourage her, if you can, to give an account of herself that exceeds the pixelated Instagram version. Rooting for the cat, James. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast on our website at ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.